Hello and welcome to the latest episode of the Minorities in Publishing podcast. This is Jen, and for new and returning listeners, you may know you can find the podcast on Tumblr at minoritiesinpublishing.tumblr.com or on Twitter at minoritiesinpub, where you can also sign up for the newsletter. As we approach the year end, we have a slew of phenomenal books coming out, and I think by the time this episode will air, Case and Callender's Queen of the Conquered will be out, which is their first adult book. But you very well may know Kaysen because they are the award-winning author of Hurricane Child, which I adored. Such a good book. King and the Dragonflies, which comes out next year, 2020, February. This is kind of an epic love story. And Felix Ever After, which also comes out next year in May. Is that right, Kaysen?
Yeah, that's right.
All right. So you're busy, as we've established.
Yeah, that's the way I like to be.
And this is also an online conversation because Kaysen does not live in New York City anymore, which may be a very, very good thing for them. But welcome to the podcast, Kaysen. I'm so happy to be able to talk to you.
Thanks for having me.
I want to get into various things because you used to be in the industry in another capacity. You used to be an editor as well.
Right.
Specifically for Kid Lit.
Yeah, I was an associate editor at Little Brown Books Generators.
And then you left to focus more on your writing. So I'm curious, publishing professional to publishing professional, you know, that balance of being the writer and then also doing the full-time job. It's not as easy as I think people might think. It's doable. It's absolutely doable. But I think there's just something to that, especially when you're doing acquisitions as well. That's not a 9-to-5 job whatsoever.
It's not. I was really bringing my work back every night and on the weekends, because especially when you're working in publishing as a writer, I just wanted to make sure that the books that I was being entrusted with were given the first priority. I would really hate it if I, as a writer, knew that someone else was kind of putting my stories to the side so that they could focus on their own work. So I was waking up at 4 in the morning sometimes just to get my own writing in, but then getting into work at like 6 in the morning to get the administrative tasks done, and then leaving sometimes at 10, and then going home and still kind of like doing the editorial work that needed to be done. So that was rough. Those were a rough few months.
Wow.
Yeah.
And that's just something I think no one really knows about. Because I feel as though, again, I'm privileged being in the industry and seeing it. But where I am, I do acquisitions for an online journal. But it's very different when you're doing book acquisitions. There's so much in terms of the politics, in terms of what you want to acquire, so much about community acquisitions, too. Because it's not just singularly, I love this book, and then I'm going to make it happen. You know, like there's a community factor to that as well. So did you find that helpful as an author too, just to see that, to be in that?
Well, I think the most helpful thing for me was realizing how much of a business it really is. Because as a writer, you know, it's like my heart and soul. This is how I get all my creativity out there, how I say what I want to say to the world. But it's easy to kind of forget that that is kind of like the heart and soul and kind of like love and being and all that kind of like creative stuff. It's easy to forget that it's a business, and you have to remember that money needs to come in, and you need to be able to market yourself, and you need to be able to speak publicly about your work, and just kind of like all these different aspects that I never really considered before I got into the industry. It just helped me look at the larger picture a lot more. It's not just about my writing. It's not just about, you know, telling my story. It's about making sure that I'm keeping up with the market and knowledgeable about other titles that are out there and being an independent business, really.
I wonder also about the business acumen part of it, too, like you were mentioning. I remember my aunt had subscribed me to Writer's Digest and Poets and Writers when I was in college, and this is going on almost 20 years ago. And it was really helpful for me at the time just to understand more of it. This was even before I join the industry as a publishing professional. But some people have said that, you know, knowing the business side could actually hurt the creativity. And maybe it's just a matter of compartmentalization. You know, there's the business person, like you said, and then there's the artistic person, and they can be one in the same human form. But for some people, that's not possible.
I say that's actually good for the people are able to compartmentalize and are able to kind of not look at the business side of things, because I think, you know, depending on the person, it could be great to just focus on the creativity and not have to worry about the money. And if that works for that person, then that's awesome. I know that for me, it can, like, remembering the business side and remembering the reviews and remembering how this book isn't selling as well as it could, like, what should I be doing differently? You know, all of that can really definitely get into my head as I'm trying to write, which isn't always great. But at the same time, I personally want to remember those aspects, because then it helps me shape what next book I'm going to write and why, and what story am I trying to tell, and not necessarily story just for the sake of story in kind of like a vacuum, but story for the sake of what's happening in the market. Is it in response to another book that's out there? Is it way too similar? Is it the exact same premise to a book that is getting a lot of attention right now? Is that necessary to write that book at this moment? Or can I write another book that I have another idea for that feels a little different from what's happening? You know, so many different aspects to kind of think about. For me, it's important to remember the business side of things.
So you're out of the business in one facet. I'm not going to comment on whether one is easier or not. I know it's not easier to write at all. And it's really draining to sell. It's so draining to do the touring because it doesn't stop. I feel like people think, oh, you're done now, right? And you're like, are you high? No, I'm not done.
I started to travel a lot more than I have in the past this year. And it is so draining. It can be really exciting to get to meet people and get to meet readers, and especially young readers. All of that is why I'm still doing it, along with needing to get my book out there. But it is so tiring. And sometimes I speak to authors who haven't been home in months. They'll tell me that they're going from one conference to the next. They maybe have been home for like one weekend within a 5 month time span. And it's like, I personally cannot do that. Mm-hmm. Kudos to whoever can. But that is absolutely exhausting.
Especially when you don't even know where you're going, really. You know what I mean? Yeah. I feel like sometimes for us, it's a crapshoot as marginalized artists. And I recognize my privilege in this as like a cishet woman too, and an able-bodied woman. I don't have to worry about stairs and da-da-da-da. And I find that, you know, going to conferences, that's something that's just not thought of a lot.
Mm-hmm. Oh, for sure, yeah.
Yeah, like I just went to one in Virginia and it was all steps. Like there were steps to the room. So you can take an elevator to the floor, but there were steps to your room. Exactly.
Yeah, I was just thinking about that as I went to Kentucky. I was at the Muhammad Ali Center. And at first I didn't see that there was an elevator to the top floor to get into the building. Mm-hmm. So I was like, how do people get into this if they can't use the stairs? But luckily I didn't see the elevator. Mm-hmm. I did think about that. And then I thought about the fact that there are just different locations throughout the state where I'm not always going to feel automatically comfortable as a Black person, as a trans person. Using the bathroom suddenly was this incredibly stressful thing. Mm-hmm. You know, there are a lot of things to think about it, as marginalized people traveling, for sure.
Yeah. It just weighs on you. And just, I don't know how people who can do this for 5 months.
Yeah.
I just don't. But I hope they're getting a good paycheck and, you know, good sales from it at the very least. So I want to get into the writing. I recently did this piece for a school library journal where I talked to Akweke Emeze and Bethany Morrow and Morgan Parker, and they really wanted to focus on crossover. You know how sometimes your debut is what you become known for, especially when the debut does that very well, like Hurricane Child, as have your other books have done very well. So you came onto the scene as a Kidlit writer, and you were also an editor for Kidlit. So we're coming into Queen of the Conquered, and that's your adult book. Because it is vastly different. Like, the warm fuzzies ain't there, Kason.
I hope I don't put this person on blast. You know, I have nothing but good feelings to this. I just chuckled a little bit. Like, someone on Twitter I saw was very upset that Queen of the Conquered was nothing like this. Is kind of an epic love story. And I just wanted to say, oh boy. Yeah, no, like, if you read the descriptions, you know, epic love story, cute distempered rom-com, Queen of the Conquered, bloody, brutal Game of Thrones. You can't get more different. I'm so sorry.
Yeah. I mean, they have more to look forward to in 2020, so.
Yeah. Look for Felix Ever After. I think that you would enjoy that.
Okay. But that's part of it, right, is you come on the scene and everyone's like, oh, I love this. Do more of that. Because that's what I like that you did first. And now you're coming on and you're switching gears big time for Queen of the Conquered. I mean, I haven't read the upcoming books. I'm psyched for them. But I feel, again, we come into that compartmentalization. But I wondered, and I was asking Kweke and Morgan and Bethany this, because there is a different approach. No matter what someone's feelings are of audience, some people don't want to be labeled as kidlit writers. I don't know that Case and Callender should be labeled as a kidlit writer, and I don't know that you feel comfortable with that. That's totally up to you. But it feels like there's definitely a different capacity of thinking in the execution. Especially when you're thinking of the young reader, because the young reader is starring in that book as well. So I'm wondering, as we ease into discussion on Queen of the Conquered, how do you, as a writer, approach these, especially middle grade is so different. Like YA, there's bloody YA too. So,
you know, that's true.
But, you know, going middle grade, young adult, adult, and then going middle grade again, young adult. But how did you go about that in terms of the execution and who you were thinking about in terms of the end reader?
Yeah, the difference for me for all the different age ranges comes down to the hope that's at the end of the book. For the younger audiences, I personally feel like it is very important to make sure that the reader understands that there is still hope in this world. I feel like at that age, and especially because I struggled so much with depression and mental health when I was younger, I felt like there was absolutely no hope. And if my books at that age that I was reading also kind of just solidified that sort of thinking, then I don't know that I would still be here. I really needed books that continue to suggest that, yeah, things are tough right now, but you will make it through. For the adult age ranges, I hope that at this point we have lived long enough to see that there are the dark times, but there is still hope for things to change. And even if it's a cycle, by this point, things can still get better. So I feel more comfortable with an ending that is just brutal and doesn't necessarily suggest that things will be perfect for the characters in this story. I feel like YA is also kind of in the center of that, where there can be a good mix, where I want the middle grade to be as hopeful as possible. YA can be, you know, realistic, hopeful, not completely devastating at the end, for my taste anyway, for my personal writing. And the adult can be, there's just absolutely no hope for any of these characters. That's how I approach the different aspects of writing for the different age ranges.
So I'm really glad you brought up this hope angle as we get into Queen of the Conquered. And in terms of Queen of the Conquered, can you give us kind of a quick summary?
Sure. So Queen of the Conquered is about Sigourney Rose and her quest for revenge against the colonizers, basically kind of white European-inspired folk who come down to her Caribbean-inspired islands and enslaved her people and slaughtered her family. So she wants revenge, and she needs to get onto this kind of royal island where the different nobles of these royal families have gathered for what's known as the storm season. The king of the royal island is about to give up power to any one of these noble families, and her way of getting revenge is to try to get that power from the colonizers. But as soon as she gets there, it becomes clear that someone on the island is killing all of the nobles one by one, and she needs to figure out who it is before they kill her next. And there's a good dash of magic called craft. She has different people throughout the story have, where she has the ability to control minds and even sometimes control bodies. So it's a fantasy, Caribbean-inspired, sort of Shakespearean. One person said it's Shakespeare meets Agatha Christie. I thought that was a great description of it.
So when we come to Sigourney, do you feel like she's hopeful? Because she's so hell-bent. She has a singular mission, and it seems that's what drives her. I mean, I know she's your character, so maybe it's a little unfair. but that hope you were talking about in terms of her as a character, not so much the book itself, but her.
Yeah, that's a very good question, because for her character, she's a very morally gray character. You hear that description and you immediately think, oh yeah, she's a freedom fighter. Of course I'm going to be on her side. Yeah, I wanted to take a look at Sigourney's morally gray character through the lens of privilege, because I think that that's an aspect you don't necessarily always look at, is even as an oppressed person, I also have my privilege. We were discussing this earlier with kind of like being able-bodied, for example. Another aspect of that is being, when I was in St. Thomas growing up, and from St. Thomas, the U.S. Virgin Islands, I was privileged enough to be sent to a private school, for example. But even then, I was still the only Black person in the room, and I was bullied and discriminated for years. And then, you know, I came to the States and I went to basically another almost all white college, again, had the privilege to attend a very expensive school, but was still discriminated against as the only black person in the room. And then went to New York, you know, it's kind of like this running theme in my life where I went to New York and in the publishing, you know, had the privilege to be able to afford to live in such an expensive city or even to make it into the room in publishing, but I was the only black person there for years. So I wanted to take a look at the way that discrimination and oppression interacts when you see yourself have privilege. A lot of Sigourney's struggle with that was inspired by my own kind of struggles with being a person with privilege, but is also oppressed. The question of hope for Sigourney comes in with her question of whether she can be redeemed. Because as such a morally great character, she herself like looks down on her own people and she herself is a slave owner, even as she is trying to even as she tells herself she's trying to free her people, she also owns slaves. And that's something that I was inspired by years and years ago when I first heard that black people had owned slaves. Historically, I think I was a teenager, I was just like blown over. The question remained with me like all these years, how can you do that to your own people? And I think that that's another question that kind of like birds Sigourney's character. So ultimately the question of hope is rooted in whether she herself can be redeemed as a morally great character, whether she can redeem herself from all the mistakes that she's making throughout the story. Mm-hmm. And I'm not going to answer that question because then it would spoil the ending.
Yeah, exactly. We can't. It made me think about Obama, too. This belief that, and I don't know Obama, but remember the election 2008? And, you know, the whole thing was, like you said, hope. That was the whole campaign. Change is coming. We can do this. We will. Yes, we can. I believe that was their tag. It was, yes, we can. That was the campaign. And then I can only imagine what it's like for someone like Obama to be the first, be the only, and get into the space and really come in with those quote unquote radical ideas and then realize you're just, the power structure is so embedded in ableism, white supremacy, homophobia, transphobia, like it just is. This is what the system is because it's very much built by colonizers. And it made me think when I was coming to Sigourney, because I'm going to admit, I was like, girl, are you serious right now? Like, do you really think once you get in there that things are going to change? You know
what I mean? Yeah, and I'm happy you said that because that is, and this is getting into the sequel a little bit also, so I have to be a little bit careful not to spoil things, but that is a big question throughout the book is whether she realizes that she will really be able to change the system or whether she is actually just a part of that system, even as she tells herself she wants to destroy it and she wants to kind of overcome the system of privilege and oppression by being the top person. Is she actually changing that or is she just becoming a part of it by joining that system, even if she is the queen of the islands?
And the added effect of giving her the ability to see what people think of her consistently, the pain of that and the stress of that and the appearance of strength and fortitude for her of I can never, which is just like, especially she is a black woman's burden of like, you don't get to be this. And then you're in the room and you're the target and she's always dealing with it. So I'm wondering also as creator, you're saying the aim was to create a morally gray character. But in the execution of that, that can be very difficult. How'd you do that? Or at least how did you approach it? Because like you said, you're saying this is what you wanted to do, but you're having this world and this confluence of factors going on. Like at the end of the day, was it just Kaysen saying, okay, I think this is just who she is and we're going to have to take from it as individual reader what we take from it. Because I totally see where you're going and I felt that. I think you were very successful in what you were aiming to do. I'm also a black woman.
Yeah. I mean. For the morally gray aspect of things, I think I went in really just wanting to write a realistic character. First and foremost, I think it's difficult for all of us to kind of look at our own privilege and look at the way that we are also helping the system that we're in. We don't really want to look at that. Mm-hmm. We don't really want to look at how all the technology that we own is kind of like destroying people's own freedoms as they're kind of like forced to work, or even just corporations like Amazon,
Facebook.
You know, it's difficult for us to take a look at the fact that we are in a society where we are trying to get our own privileges and our own comforts, and we are helping this system of oppression just by existing in it. And I wanted to look at Sigourney's character. I wanted to create Sigourney's character kind of like as a symbol for all of us. We are Sigourney. Mm-hmm. As ridiculous as that sounds, each of us are making the same mistake that Sigourney is making, mm-hmm. just by being a part of the system. That's ultimately what I went out to do by creating a morally gray character. I kind of wanted to take a look at the fact that we're all morally gray and all of our choices. Mm-hmm. The fact that we are part of the system means we're making the same mistakes that Sigourney made. And I personally look at the story and think, I hope to God I would never do the things that Sigourney would do. But it's also so difficult to know, like, historically, if we were a black person with the privilege to own slaves, would we have? I mm-hmm. hope to God no. Mm-hmm. I really hope to God no. At the same time, we're also doing the same thing right now. We're in the system of oppression, and we are kind of going along with it rather than burning it down, basically, you know?
I feel like the magic helps enhance it, because then she has that additional factor of hearing people's thoughts, and then, you know, there's the pissing contest, so to speak, when it comes to her meeting the other royals. Well, I can do this, and I can do this, and this is a threat to me, and da 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 da. Was that always part of the plot, or in terms of the execution of the story, that you wanted to have some magical elements as well? Because I think with or without it, it still would have played out similarly to how you thought. Especially with how much difficulty it was in terms of unraveling the crescendo, so to speak.
Which we will not talk about.
I won't, I promise.
The magical element was really important from the beginning for me, because it was also a symbol of the ways that society has decided who is allowed to have the power. So Kraft actually is a Danish word, and it means literally power. So there are some times when I have a little bit fun with, like, the word choice, and I'll say, who gets to have the craft? I'm literally asking, like, who gets to have the power? You know, from the beginning, it's said that the royals, the Fearn, as they're called, the colonizers and oppressors, they will execute anyone who has power who is an islander. So that's their way of literally taking power from the islanders and saying, you're not allowed to have this ability that can further you. And that's just a metaphor for society right now. Who's allowed to have the power to go to school, to have the jobs that will further enhance themselves in this society? There are people who are being oppressed in that same way. They're not being executed literally, except now as I'm speaking, yes, they are. Black people are literally being executed every day by police. So, you know, that's all to say that it's just a metaphor for the way our society works. With Sigourney's power in particular, that was important to me, for her to be able to read minds, control bodies, because, you know, I used to identify as a black woman. I'm trans, I'm non-binary. Even as a non-binary person who's also black, I feel like we can always kind of sense what a white person is thinking. I feel like we can always sense how we are being viewed in society. We walk down the street and we can feel the gaze of, like, the white gaze just looking at us and thinking, that's a black person with their black skin and their thick hair and their wide nose and their wide mouths. The way that Sigourney constantly sees the white people kind of, like, looking at her as well and viewing her and judging her for her skin tone and not seeing the power and beauty in her and thinking that the way that she looks and her race equals, like, monstrosity because of the way that we've been brainwashed in the society to view black people. So I wanted her to be able to look at the racism in a way that I feel like I can see it very clearly whenever I'm walking down the street or whenever I'm the only black person in the room, if that makes sense.
So they are Dutch. I had a feeling.
Yeah,
the colonizers.
Yeah, they're Danish. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because it's based on the U.S. Virgin Islands. So historically, we were owned by the Dutch before we were sold to the United States. So everything, a lot of the words and a lot of the island names and street names and the names of the manors were taken mm-hmm. from street names and island names that are in the Virgin Islands. So mm-hmm. Hans Lolik is a real island in the Virgin Islands. So I changed the spelling just a little bit. Mm-hmm.
So I want to get into that, actually, because Hurricane Child, I haven't read Epic Love Story, but it seems like so much of your writing is also very much embedded in the Virgin Islands and Caribbean and all that stuff, which is so nice to see. But I also think it lends me being born and raised stateside New York City. It adds such a level of, I think, poetry and a dynamicness to your work, which is like what I just loved about your writing in general. Thanks. So, and I don't know if that's because I'm sure we had very different educations as children. So I'm interested in like, what were you reading and all that stuff to like kind of cater to your voice, to develop your voice?
As a child, because I did go to private school that had a lot of teachers that were basically all from the States, I did feel like I got an education that was...
Really?
Yeah, that was kind of, I don't know, I can't blame my mom for sending me there because I knew that she would want, a lot of people kind of have this feeling that you have to leave the island to go stateside for school and for jobs, and then hopefully you'll be able to return. So I feel like she was trying to prepare me for that. So I did go to a school that kind of basically, I feel like it almost suppressed my education in that way, though, because it was giving me kind of the quote-unquote classics. You know, I never really read a lot of kind of like empowering Black literature until I kind of Caribbean literature until I got to school. The stage, which is really ironic because I went to Sarah Lawrence, and it's just so many white people. It's just so many white people. But there were a lot of masses there that used to kind of like Black and Caribbean literature. And I feel like that was really my awakening. Like, yeah, I had the lyricism, I had the feeling of the islands kind of like in my blood still as I was writing. But for as far as like literature goes, it wasn't until college that I was reading Jamaica Kincaid and I was reading Marlon James. The Book of Night Women definitely influenced Queen of the Conquered quite a lot.
Oh, wow. Okay, so yeah, that sounds pretty similar.
Yeah.
I'm thinking, I'm like, what were you reading down there? Wasn't it amazing? You're like, a lot of white people.
No,
a lot of dead white people.
It really was, yeah.
Like, damn it.
I'm curious to know, like at the other schools on St. Thomas, I'm pretty sure it was the same thing because it's wherever you go, there's this system that kind of forces you to think that this is what classic literature is and this is what you have to read. You have to read the Shakespeare, you have to read the whatever, Jane Austen, et cetera, to be able to be considered educated, which isn't great. Mm-hmm. I should have been reading Toni Morrison in high school, not Shakespeare.
We're self-correcting, so to speak. Well, hopefully they have Case and Calendar on their curricula now. Down there or here, everywhere.
Right.
It would be. Just like, let's put some local authors on the curriculum. Like, that's sweet. So how are you feeling with Queen of the Conquered? Because it is, quote unquote, an adult book. You know, that is different from epic love story in the American Child. Like, it's so different.
It's so different.
Like, hey, gather around, children. Let me tell you a story about colonization and people getting their heads cut off.
Yeah.
I mean, you probably have already, obviously, been talking about it and all that stuff, but it is going to be different audiences that you're going to be talking to and that different spaces that you're going to be on, and it's a different discussion. It's similar. It parallels. You do talk about racism and, you know, power and all that stuff in your other books. Like you said, like that offended reader who was like, I don't understand why this isn't a rom-com. I mean, I'll hint that there is some romance. Definitely not comedic.
Yeah, no. And I, even for Queen of the Conquered, I feel like there isn't any romance. There's maybe, you know, there's sexual relations, I'd say, but because of, like, the power dynamics, I felt like it was important. This isn't your typical, all of the kind of, like, slave narratives that had Black women falling in love with the white slave master, who I cringe even saying that out loud. I just kind of wanted to fight against that. But yeah, I'm really excited. I'm super excited to be in a new space. Curious to know what that space is like. I'm learning a lot about the community now. I feel like I've been so entrenched in the kidlit world that I know what children's and teen community is like, especially like online and social media, but I have no idea what the adult fantasy spec world is like. So I'm very curious to know what that's all about and to meet other authors and hopefully go to conferences and just continue to grow in that space. Mm-hmm. I was just gonna say, I am a little nervous that some people would continue to confuse the different books. So I do want to make it a little bit more clear that they're each in very different categories.
It would be interesting.
Read all and be a fan of all, but
Yeah, I think you can be, you know,
for rom-com Queen of the Conquered.
Like, maybe after Queen of the Conquered, read Epic Love Story. A palate cleanser, right. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah. That's a good idea.
But I also, that leads to my last question. There is love here in Queen of the Conquered. Like, I think I'm joking a lot, like, it's so dark, and it is dark. But that doesn't mean that there's not love and that you as author haven't tethered that to Sigourney's journey, so to speak. The woman who saved her and even those who serve her. It is this weird dichotomy, as you said. How can you love someone you serve and how can you love someone who's your master? Those relationships are very complicated. But I do feel like there's love there.
Yeah, I think that there's definitely love with Sigourney and her memories of her family. I feel like that is real and probably why it's the most painful, because for me, it's interesting hearing you say that, because I do feel like now that I put the story out into the world, it's not whatever I say is law. I'm interested to hear other people's takes on it. For me, I think that that's what's most painful, is that I feel like the love that she had for her family and the fact her family had for her was the only true love, and now it's gone. And that's what kind of like drives her anger and her need for revenge, and she is constantly seeking that love in others. But I do kind of like ask the question, I think, can it actually be love if you're in such different power dynamics? So the woman, Rika, that is kind of like Sigourney's almost like handmaiden and is like helping her throughout this journey, she has like this mother figure, and yet she's still Sigourney's slave, and Sigourney has technically freed her, but where is she supposed to go? She has no choice but to stay by Sigourney's side. And it's that question of choice that I think really makes it kind of like adds to the discussion. Can it actually be love if you have no choice but to be by this person's side? I don't know. That's why I'm interested in Sigourney's character a lot, because that dynamic, the question of like the morally gray aspect to her character, the fact that she craves love so much, and you kind of have to, you almost have no choice but to be sympathetic. Like, you can't help but be sympathetic to someone who has lost their entire family and wants to be loved and wants to be respected, but is so entrenched in a system that she can't take herself out of it, and she's adding to that system by oppressing others, that you also kind of like hate her for it. It's just this kind of mess and confusion of emotions and response. Like, you love her and you hate her, and I don't want to go on because then I'll end up spoiling the book, but yeah, that's ultimately, I think, like the question of whether there's love in the book. It just kind of like adds to the fact that she is such a morally gray character.
It does. I mean, I have feelings about Sigourney.
I hope that you do. I hope that everyone who reads it has feelings about Sigourney.
We're gonna form a book club, just like the feelings book club. We're just gonna talk about like a range of books that really incited these complicated, I'll say again, feelings. Because yeah, I mean, there's a level of naivete I feel for her. I feel sympathy. I feel a lot of things, like I said, but I definitely feel sympathy, but I'm also, you know, just like, seriously? Because like you said, Marika tells her, you know, and then it sounds like sometimes Sigourney's being a soldier in respects and thinking ahead, but also sometimes she's being kind of a child, a petulant child in some ways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's a lot.
For sure, it really is.
It's a lot, and it's a good book. And Queen of the Conquered, which comes out November 12th. So, Kaysen, how may people reach out to you, find out more about your work, since you have a slew of books coming out?
You'd be so inclined. You can go to my website, which is my first name and my last name, kaysencalendar.com. And I also am on social media. You can search for me on Twitter and Instagram. And I also have a new Facebook page.
Oh, cool. And it's Kaysen, K-A-C-E-N, calendar, C-A-L-L-E-N-D-E-R.
Exactly. Yeah.
And I highly suggest you do, because Kaysen's busy.
So. Yeah.
Not 5 months traveling in a row busy, but busy.
Yeah, for sure.
So I've loved this conversation. Thank you so much for sharing this book with me early. I feel very privileged to have gotten an early reader's copy. I am always down for new Kaysen books, so this has been a delight.
Cool. Thank you so much for having me.
And for those who are listening, once again, this is the Minorities in Publishing podcast, which you can find at minoritiesinpublishing.tumblr.com or on Twitter at minoritiesinpub. Thanks again. And remember, Queen of the Conquered comes out November 12th.